All right, so half or second out of three lectures in communication before we hit the midterm. So the schedule here is, today we've got this middle lecture on modalities of communication. Then we talk about, interesting examples of communication involve costs and interspecies interactions. So that's next week on Tuesday. Then Thursday, a week from this week, is our midterm review. So bring your questions. I will have kind of highlights of the slides that I'll present just as a means to generate questions. But if people come with questions, we can just talk about the questions. So that's that. On the subject of review, I believe Anushka and Sean have both posted some information about review sessions that they'll be holding in case that will be valuable to you. So you can reach out to them about information about that and where they're holding that and how they're doing that. So that's an option. Also, there's office hours, student support hours. So those are posted for all three of us. So if you haven't noticed that, then if you go to the main Canvas page, there's an instructor staff support hours link right on the main page. It's also in the course information module. Like I have Zoom student support hours from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. every Monday. So people are tuned up for or tuned into that. But then also these guys have got that as well. So if you have questions that you want a more one-on-one, then feel free to make use of that. So that's the kind of schedule here. Then in the midterm, it'll be the week right before that, the fall break. And it's Canvas-based. And stage one will actually be available at least Monday and Tuesday, stage two, Thursday and Friday. Still deciding on what I'll do with Wednesday. The stage one is timed, individual, lock down browser. Stage two is untimed, and you can collaborate with anyone enrolled in the course. And there are a practice exam from last fall is available, as well as some other resources in the midterm module. But in order to get into the midterm module, you have to take a lockdown browser compliance test. So go ahead and do that as soon as you can. There was an issue with lockdown browser that I fixed. So if you tried to do it and it gave you some pop-up about, an error trying to get into it, just try it again. And I've confirmed some students have gotten into it. So and open up that module and you can see the full exam and its solutions from last fall. And the current exam will be a very similar format. Otherwise, other assignments. So the Unit D reading, which is about cricket calling, and the Unit D Canvas exercise are both due next Sunday. So not this weekend, but next weekend once we finish the unit. And that's about it on these announcements. So make sure you do that compliance test soon so you can confirm that everything's working and get access to those resources. Any questions? Also, it might be a long shot. So I'm a joint appointment. So I spend a fraction of my time actually in engineering and the other fraction in life sciences. Because of my joint, and I actually wasn't originally supposed to teach this semester there, but there's another faculty member went on sabbatical. So I filled in. So because I've kind of bought down my workload in life sciences, it'll be many, many years before I teach another undergraduate course here. But if you're interested in other things that I teach that are bio adjacent, for those of you in the 4+1, I will teach a master's level course on bio-inspired AI and optimization that occasionally I do get students from the life sciences that enroll in that. So if you're interested in that, it's IEEE or CSE 598. It's in spring of 26. We talk about how to use things like population genetics to inspire algorithms that are good at finding good solutions to things using kind of evolutionary pressures to shape how they search through spaces. We talk about learning again, but how learning informs how you build things like the AI that you hear about in the news. So that stuff, it's very different than this class, but it's, there is a lot of bio in that. I mean, it's right in the name. So it might be a long shot, but for those of you in like a 4+1 that might be interested in that sort of thing, then you could take a look at that. All right, so enough of the advertising. Now, today is going to be focused on what we talked about communication fundamentals, signals and cues. That was the big thing to get out of last semester, or not in the last semester. I'm sorry, the white, it's very bright. So my visual modality is now completely blinded. But the So now that, we're going, so last time, remember, signals, cues, cue ritualization. That's the big thing to take out of the last one. We're going to see those themes repeated here. Now we're going to drill down into specific examples of communication and different ways that animals communicate. And we have to then talk about the different modalities of communication, different ways. So right now you're seeing me walk around, you're seeing me use my arms, you're hearing me talk. These are different modalities that are combined into a multimodal signal. So we talked about communication modes or modalities. It's the type of sensory receptor used to receive a signal. So if you use your ears to receive the signal, it's acoustic or auditory. If you use your nose or tongue, it's olfactory. If you use, if it's tactile, touch, and so on. So these are what I mean by modalities. And so these are sort of the standard ones that we're familiar with our belt, but there are animals that also, the electric modality is very salient to them. So going back to that idea of belt, then, you have to consider not just what we can sense, but what other animals can sense and how are they using that. So we'll get into that. The first example of that, we've seen this video before of tandem running. And so let's drill down and look at the communication between these two ants. And this is a complex communication channel. So for one, there actually is this thing called a calling pheromone, and we'll talk about what a pheromone here is in just a second, but there is a little chemical cloud that gets emitted out of the butt, the gaster of this leader, and it is short-lived. So it creates a little bubble around her. It doesn't lay anything on the ground. It just exists in the air. And after you get a couple of ant links, maybe one ant link back, you can't detect it. And so she does that calling pheromone, as they call it, to maintain contact with the follower here. And then the follower then touches her on her rear end to tell her, well, apparently to cause her to start walking the little bit more of the route. And then these back and forth allows for a flow control during this route learning. So the follower can slow down the leader or it can speed up the leader as she's encoding all of that. And so also what the follower is doing here is getting visual information, cues from the environment. So we see two signals here. So we see there's this smell that is emitted into the air that we refer to as a signal, because it's not being emitted just because they're stinky. It's not like sweat, like it's just, oh, that's just a smelly ant. It's like, no, this was, it is, it's primary, it's being selected for primarily for this informational purpose to hold these two ants together. And this other stereotyped behavior, this touching with the antenna. So there's antennal movements that are sort of natural, but when an ant goes and whacks another ant with her antenna over and over again, then that, as a behaviorist, you start noticing like you just wouldn't expect that by random chance. If an ant was just waving her antenna for some other sensory reason, and she might occasionally bump into another ant, but when she's periodically touching the other ant, there could be lots of things that could be happening here. She could actually be perceiving odors with her antennae. Remember, the antennae are how ants smell. So there's kind of a reason why antennae come out of where the nostrils should be if they were, a person's face. Our nostrils are inverted antennae, or their antennae are inverted nostrils. It's like you just sucked all those out. So you had to, all of the inside of your nose was now on the outside. You get antennae. And so it could be that she's smelling, but it seems like the experiments have shown that she doesn't seem to be perceiving much odor here. She seems to be using her antennae to whack the leader on the back end, which causes the leader to keep moving. So a lot of interesting stuff going on here, two signals and then cues. So then overall, she's picking up cues and learning a route. So it's almost like the route is being transmitted from leader to follower. But the crazy thing here is actually, for all we know, this leader learned different cues than this follower. This leader is just driving the follower through an experience, which she might experience slightly differently than the leader. So it's kind of interesting there is that, there's another type of communication, but it's not a direct, it's not like she's just downloading her route into the follower. She's forcing the follower to form her own route, but she does it by following the leader. So a lot of complex communication going on here and multiple modalities to consider. So any questions about how this works, about this tandem running? You got the odor keeping them together, you got the tactile, the sort of speeding up and slowing down, and then you've got the visual cues that are actually being learned by the follower. Yeah. Yeah, well, I would say that the leader sends this contact pheromone back to the follower. So the follower, it appears like in experiments that the follower is not using her vision to maintain contact with the leader because she can see lots of ants, but she smells the leader. So if, I mean, this is weird. In Artenwelt, what I'm about to say is weird. But if I wanted to learn how to get from here to, I don't know, PSH, some other building, and you knew the route and I didn't, I might say, hey, does anybody know the route to PSH? And then I wait for an odor. And then it's like, if you start smelling like a leader, then I just walk up to you and I wait for you. And then you start walking and I'm like, oh, the odor went away. Like, I need to find that odor again. Then I walk up the odor gradient and then I touch you. And then you get a little closer to PSH and a little closer to PSH. So your odor is the way you're telling me, follow me. And so that's the signal, is the follow me signal. Other questions? Okay. So let's drill down into that a little bit more. So we talked about a chemical signal. And so you talk about hormones. When you talk about anatomy and physiology, there's hormones that are inside your body that are really communication from body part to body part, a slow communication from different parts of your body that are sort of regulating other parts of your body. There is a social hormone called a pheromone, which that comes from the Greek for transfer of excitement. And so it's this idea that you can send a chemical in order to influence the behavior or physiology of another. And it's a signal because it is beneficial to both the sender and the receiver. So we'll, talk about that. Like there's a broader sense of what we call semiochemicals. So these are messaging chemicals, semiochemicals. They have meaning. But this broader set of semiochemicals, it can not necessarily have a benefit to both. So pheromones are an intra-specific semiochemical. So among the same species, they benefit both. But we can also have allomones, which only benefit the sender and they go between different species, and pheromones, which benefits the receiver only, and again, interspecific. And then cinnamones, which are kind of like the interspecific version of pheromones, they benefit both. And so, examples here, when we talk about an allomone, then what we're saying is that it's a chemical that, for example, let's say that it softens the leaves of a tree, or it causes it maybe, or it makes it harder for a prey item to notice a predator coming on. So maybe there's an odor that confuses a prey item. So when the odor's there, then the prey don't notice that the predator are coming on. So that would be an example of something that benefits the emitter of the odor, but not the receiver. But there could be pheromones. So these would be chemicals that do the opposite. So the predator is just stinky because it's a sweaty, stinky mammal. And when that odor comes on, then the prey can detect that and then they can run off. And so that odor, that chemical that is benefiting the prey, that's what we're saying is this chiromone. And then the cinnamones, then you can actually now, in the case of mutualisms that are beneficial to both, so symbiotic mutualisms, then you can have cinnamones where you can actually have chemicals that benefit both. And so you have ants that live in trees. Those trees actually sometimes recruit ants to leaf damage. So you might actually have a mammal starts munching on some leaves, and the vibration might actually recruit ants, but the tree actually could start releasing a chemical which ramps up the ants, and then the ants come rushing out, and then they attack the mammal that is now chewing on the tree. And that is going to benefit the ants because it maintains their home and it benefits the tree as well. So you get a benefit to both. So semiochemicals, this broad sense, pheromone, when it benefits both within the species, we call it a pheromone. So, questions about those definitions? The intra and inter is interesting because the intra, within species, that's a possibility for genes to affect both sender and receiver simultaneously. If you have genes for a particular production of a chemical that is used in signaling, that gene might be expressed in the receiver as well. That allele might be expressed in the receiver as well, but it might be expressed. There's this thing called pleiotropy, which means one gene is used in multiple traits. So you can have one gene that has a sender trait, but that same allele also creates a receiver trait, which is complementary. And so, the intra-specific is interesting from an evolutionary perspective because there's a lot more opportunities for those signals to evolve because they kind of in the population, if you can get this kind of pleiotropy that shows up, it makes it more rapid. You can get a lot more elaboration of that. Interspecific is almost interesting because that can't happen. So then you really do need kind of a coevolution where you've got one evolutionary process that has to become kind of in sync with another evolutionary process. So selection for these alleles needs to sort of happen at the same time for selection for these alleles, and they kind of have to synchronize up in a frequency-dependent way. So that's why we often are so fixated on intra and inter because of the evolutionary implications. Questions about any of that? Okay. So I just want to mention, because remember we talked about ritualization, this calling pheromone. So this is a leader ant that does this tandem running. So it's the pheromone, it's the signal that's being sent from leader to follower. It's coming out of her gaster, out of here. It comes in this genus, so in this group of ants, it comes from their poison gland. This is a gland that across ants is well known for its involvement in venom production. In poison, that is used in defense and offense, but in these interspecific interactions. And by the way, there are now people that are arguing that venom should be looked at as a semiochemical, as a messaging chemical, not as this kind of attack thing. But anyways, this is intraspecific now, but it was originally used for a lot of interspecifics. It was used for predation, defense, those sorts of things, this poison gland, but it got co-opted. It's a stinky chemical. It's a volatile chemical. We're going to talk about what it means to be a volatile chemical in a second, but it's released into the air and can be sensed at some small distance away. And so this volatile pheromone originally was not for communication, but it ended up being a valuable cue for both senders and receivers because, as one possible narrative, a sender, an ant, became aware of a good food location, for example, and happened to be walking toward that location. And it just so happened that ants that were maybe ramped up or amped up about food just got a little, I don't know, aggressive or something like that. And they started leaking a little bit of this poison gland secretion into the air more than other ants that had not found food. Who knows how the physiological correlation happened, but it was there. And another set of ants happened to smell that and for some reason had a conspecific attraction to this smell. And that might be how you got the evolve, how tandem running evolved is originally for something else. The cue happened to be beneficial to both sender and receiver. And over time, ants that had this consistent stinkiness were the ones that did better in the environment. And those colonies produced more offspring. And then that spread and got elaborated and ritualized into this, which has absolutely nothing to do with stinging anymore, even though the chemical is produced by the poison gland. So that's what we mean by ritualization. And so I mentioned it's volatile, and there's also non-volatile contact pheromones. So this ant not only is putting stuff in the air, she's also has stuff on her body that doesn't leave her body. But if you touch her body with your inverted nostrils, with your antennae, you can now perceive that. So we've got the volatile ones in the air, And the non-volatile ones that are the physically on the ant or physically on the environment. Any questions about those definitions or this idea of ritualization of what started out as a stinky physiological thing that became an information-bearing thing? Okay. All right. So, how do we know all of this stuff? There are these experiments that if you're interested in doing, the Bio-435 is a great, I think usually this is offered in the spring. So in Bio-435, you do methods like these ones here. So like what they did is they said, hypothetically speaking, there's different possible things that could be being emitted into the air. It could be from the poison gland. It could be from other parts of the ant's physiology. So at some point they broke a leader ant, like they up into parts, and they found, is it from the head? Like, are heads attractive? Are squished heads attractive? Are squished butts attractive? And eventually they located it's something in the gastrin, it's something in the abdomen, the butt of the ant. And then there's only a couple things in that abdomen. So there's sting glands, there's this thing called a Dufour's gland, there's the poison gland, which is the sting glands here. And so what they did is they said, okay, well, we can take the sting. So we can take that part of the anatomy of the ant with its poison Dufour's glands, and we can see, will an ant follow that? We can also just have a scentless dummy. So maybe something that is the same size as a sting. Maybe it's a sting, but we've gotten rid of the glands entirely. We can have a gaster where we pull out the glands, and then we can have dummy, like a piece of paper, what we've smeared with chemicals from poison gland, or a piece of paper that we've smeared from chemicals from this other gland that's in the abdomen, the Dufour's gland. Doesn't matter what the Dufour's gland does, it's just another gland that's in the abdomen. And what they find is, this is the number of times they did it, and this is the percentage of times that a follower followed that manipulation, followed, none of these are real ants. These are all pieces of ants or paper with chemicals on them. And you can see that 100% of the time when you have a sting that has these two glands in it, it gets followed. So it could be the poison gland, could be the Dufour's gland, could be a combination of both. But then if you extract just the poison substance or just the Dufour's and you put it on a little piece of paper or a dummy, and then you find out that 100% of the time they follow the poison, and they never just followed the Dufour's. So then that ends up suggesting that supports the hypothesis that is this poison gland that is the signal. The poison is the actual chemical signal that is holding the follower to the leader. So that's the experiment that's done there. And those are the types of experiments, again, that if you're interested in trying that stuff yourself, you can do these types of experiments in Bio-435. So questions about that experiment or those results, how that leads to the conclusion that this is the particular chemical that's being used. Okay. And then like I mentioned before, this chemical was not originally for communication. It evolved for purposes having to do with defense and offense and predation and so on. So it's used in stinging, all the things. Now, even the sting is something that originally was for laying eggs. That's the reason why ants, bees, and wasps, the males can't sting you because the males can't lay eggs. And so the ovipositor, the egg-laying device, is what got, co-opted into a sting. And then, this compound, which was involved in stinging, got co-opted into communication, which, so it turns out the males don't do anything. So we can't really say, ask, like, the males, they're pretty much an ant colony is all females. So we never see like males recruiting, but even if they did recruit, then it brings up the question of could they recruit if this is the primary way of recruiting because it's gone through this sting-related pathway. Okay, questions about any of that? Co-option, ritualization in this chemical sense. Okay. Now I mentioned non-contact pheromones. Now, insects, not just ants, bees, wasps, are covered in something called a cuticular hydrocarbon, a CHC. This is a moisturizer for ants. It's a waxy, substance that is all over their bodies. It's a moisturizer for insects. It's used to prevent desiccation. Just like if you get dry skin in the Phoenix low humidity environment, and so you start putting on moisturizer and it holds your moisture in, it prevents it from evaporating. That's what CHCs do in an insect body. And so, waxy chemicals on the outside of insects, the cuticle of insects, they're produced by these things called oenocytes. I've only mentioned that here so we can process these data. You don't need to worry about what an oenocyte is, but do know cuticular hydrocarbons because they're really big in the animal community, trying to understand, like we need to know they exist. So in this study here, this is with Drosophila fruit flies. And so you can engineer Drosophila to express different things, or you can knock out different things. And so they produced a line of fruit flies that have no oenocytes. They cannot produce cuticular hydrocarbons. So it's like they're born without moisturizer. And so those oenocyte-less ones, this is what a survival curve. So over time, very quickly they die out. Now they could die out for all sorts of reasons, but they said, well, what if we take the oenocyte-less females who don't produce their own cuticular hydrocarbons, and we apply hydrocarbons to them? We actually put moisturizing lotion on them, and it turns out you get a normal, more normal survival curve. So they said, okay, what if we take the oenocyte-less females, and then we're going to actually let them mate. So now they're going to mate with males that do have cuticular hydrocarbons. And it turns out that they also have this same survival curve. So it turns out that the females actually can get the moisturizing lotion off of the males' bodies during copulation. And that's enough to rescue some of this effect here. So it really shows that these cuticular hydrocarbons are super important in insect survival. So, and as far as we can tell, looking at the phylogeny, doing the evolutionary analysis, this came first before any communication adaptations, but then it's gotten co-opted into communication as well. So it's on their cuticle, it's preventing them from drying out, but now that it's there, it's stinky. And because it's stinky, it can be co-opted for signaling. And that's what we're going to see here. So this is just summarizing what I just said. You can engineer flies without CHCs. They die. You put the CHCs on them, they survive. All right. So they evolved to prevent insects from drying out. Remember that. CHCs are super important to communication, but they seem to, what came first was the desiccation resistance, preventing insects from drying out. Now, what makes them so good at preventing insects from drying out? And I don't want to go too much into OChem here, but just a little bit of hints of that here. So, like I said, these CHCs are a moisturizing lotion for insects. These CHCs are these long hydrocarbon chains. So they look a lot like this, just carbons and hydrogens, like a bunch of carbons together. And then, on all the spots where the carbons aren't linked to other carbons, hydrogens just plugging them up. And so then you get this long chain of 23 to 37 carbons in a line. So very long, very heavy. So that is what makes them stay put. They don't evaporate into the air because they're just so heavy. They're a big molecule. And these long chains make them waxy in nature. So they slide along each other. So they become this wax, this grease that is on the outside of these insects. And they're nonpolar as well. So that means that they're hydrophobic and they repel water. So you just get this plastic wrap around the insect and it holds all of its humidity in, prevents desiccation. So that's why they're good at anti-desiccation, desiccation resistance. So waxy, a lipid layer that's hydrophobic, plastic wrap around the ants. Now, going into co-options territory, what's cool about it is that there are lots of variations of CHCs that have all of those properties. So, like I can do lots of, as an engineer, I can do lots of things at different points here. So we've got, this is what we call an alkane. So it's sort of just a string of these CHCs, but I can then have alkenes. So I can create double bonds between these, and they work the same way. So these are all single bonds, and so the hydrogens here are sort of plugging up the other bond opportunities. But I can, pop off some hydrogens and then let these things bond together in a double bond. And so I could have a double bond here, I could have a double bond here, I could have three double bonds, I could have four double bonds. So there's all sorts of things you can do along this. And then on top of that, you can then have these things called methyl groups, and you can pop them on like little Legos. So you can put a little methyl branch here, a methyl branch here, whatever. The point I'm trying to get at is, and I'm not trying to get you to remember, what's the difference between an alkane or an alkene or a methyl branched alkane or any of that. But the point I'm trying to get at is this long chain allows you to modify it in a huge number of ways. It turns this into a barcode where, it's like you can think that this is an all black barcode, but once you put a methyl group, then now it gets a white stripe there, maybe a double bond, maybe it becomes a blue stripe, So basically, ants wear barcodes, or all insects wear barcodes all down their body. All of these barcodes are just as good at desiccation resistance, but they smell different. So it's just like, you might put on a moisturizing lotion because you like how it smells, maybe because you think other people like how it smells. You've said, you know what? I dry out in Phoenix. I need to put on moisturizing lotion, but I may as well make myself more attractive. And so maybe I'll put on a moisturizing lotion that smells a certain way because it works just as well, but now it changes how I interact with others. That's what nature is doing here. There's multiple moisturizing lotions you can put on an ant or put on a fly. So co-opt that for signaling. That's what's going on here. All right, questions about that, about this idea of creating long, waxy molecules that you can modify to create signals out of them. Yeah. It's up to you. It's up to them. So that's a great question. So if we look at an ant colony, for example, then what we see is there's going to be colony-specific odors, and then there will be caste-specific odors. And then there's the question of where do they get these odors? Do they make them themselves? Do they pick them up from around them? Does it come from the food? Those sorts of things. So, but yeah, you can have things that differentiate at a very low level or at a very high level. Okay. So, and that's going to lead into some of this stuff here is that these antennae are a chemical barcode that can identify how much of each one of these are there. So it's not just one barcode on the ant or the bee, the wasp, the fly, but it's multiple. There's a bouquet of these that are all on the ant. And so that bouquet that's on there generates an odor, which can be broken down and can tell you a lot of information, whether is this a sister of mine? If it's a sister of mine, do they do the same job as me? Where have they been lately? All of those things can be encoded onto the cuticle. And they can read them with these inverted nostrils we call antennae. They can read them, but we can read them too. We have the ability to read them with these things called mass spectrometers or mass spectrometry, so mass spec. So each one of these molecules weighs a little bit different. So you can put them into devices that sort them by weight. And then you get these outputs here. And they tell you, so at they're usually in terms of time, because it turns out these machines spit them out at different times based on how heavy they are. So you can say that, like early, these are the light ones, how much? You can say, oh, well, at this particular time, we suddenly got a pulse. And then a little bit later, we got a pulse. A little bit later, we got a huge pulse. And so what this is doing is it's sorting out which of those barcodes are on each insect and how much of that barcode is on the insect. That's what we see here. And what we can see in this particular case, this is for ants, but you do this with lots of different animals that are covered with these CHCs. This is in the same colony. Here's a queen and her profile. Here's a worker and its profile. Here's a queen egg and its profile. Here's a worker egg. In some ants, workers can lay eggs. Sometimes they aren't viable eggs. Sometimes they're just eggs that are eaten, kind of like, eat an egg for breakfast. Ants feed with eggs as well. And so if you look at that, there are some compounds, some peaks that are shared between queen and worker. and between queen and worker and egg, and even between queen egg and queen and worker egg and worker. But there are other compounds that are only on the queen and her queen egg. So you can see this like at this peak seven up here, there's also a peak seven here. Peak seven is absent in the worker. So this gets to the question about, you know, how specific are these things? We have generic colony level signals. So everyone in the colony has these peaks, but only the queen and her eggs have these peaks. So now workers, when they look at eggs, if they're processing eggs and they know that some of these eggs get fed to larvae and other eggs get raised into new workers, they can now tell the difference between the eggs by how they smell. So you can actually smell a food egg versus an egg that is meant to be developed into a new worker. Not necessarily by look, but by smell. The umwelt of the ant is very different than the way you and I perceive things. We see spectra of color, and they maybe do too. They, though, see spectra of chemicals, just as vibrant as you and I see color. So it's like me seeing a red egg and a blue egg. And I know that the blue eggs I eat and the red eggs I raise. That's what they're seeing here. Questions about this, about mass spec and how we use it to read the, so this is a GCMS, in particular, gas chromatography mass spec. You know, mass spec, that's fine. But this idea that, you know, we have lots of chemicals on the cuticle. They're all used for desiccation resistance, but they're co-opted for consistent signaling, like we have down here somewhere. Questions about that? All right. And, you know, there are people here like Jürgen Liebig. There are tons of people that Heather Bean, she has a two-dimensional mass spec that are using mass spec for this. So like Heather Bean, for example, she studies people's breath and she looks at their breath and she does this with breath. And she can then correlate that, oh, wow, this person's breath has a signature that's unique to this disease. And so she creates diagnostic tools based on the spectra that come out of here. And if you had a sensory system that could do what the ants do, that you know, if she can tell that you have a cold, the ants probably can tell that you have a cold because her giant, expensive, multi-million dollar, two-dimensional mass spec is effectively built in to the antennae of these ants. And people like Sean can study the antennae of these ants to figure out how sensitive and what these antennae are doing and what they can sense. So, you know, they've developed their mass spec devices, we've developed our mass spec devices. Okay. All right, so putting that all together, volatile and non-volatile, we have our own spectra. So over here, these non-volatile chemicals, very short range, so you actually have to touch the individual to smell. That's like these contact pheromones, or the CHCs, you have to touch them. So you don't get a lot of area spread here, but then you've got the calling pheromones with the tandem running, and that you can actually be back up. And so you can smell that there's a leader nearby. People think that this got elaborated into something known as a trail pheromone. So you know that some ants, not all, but some ants take that gastrin, instead of sticking it up in the air, they bring it down and they smear it. They paint the ground with these chemicals that evaporate, but they stay on the ground for a certain amount of time. And other ants are attracted to the chemicals on the ground. And that's referred to as a trail pheromone, which is sort of in between these two. But then, you know, you've got on the other side of this, you've got alarm pheromones that are very volatile. So an alarm pheromone, these are things that are emitted by insects and they are short. They're these tiny little molecules. And that means that you can get them up in the air and they'll stay in the air. They're not gonna fall down and you know, stick to something, or you know, they're gonna stay up in the air and they're gonna go far. And so if you happen to notice like at your hive or whatever, that there is a big mammal that's about to come in and destroy it, you send out this alarm pheromone and it goes everywhere, and the other, yeah, you know, your other colony mates, other bees, they then react. They might let out their own alarm pheromone. Never eat a banana in the desert. A banana has a chemical that is shared in the alarm pheromone of Africanized honeybees. So if you eat a banana in the desert and there happens to be some bees around, what makes one of the things that is a unique feature trait of Africanized honeybees is they're super sensitive to alarm pheromone. So with other bees, it might take like 10 bees squirting their little alarm pheromone out in the air to get that response. With like an Africanized bee, it's like one bee. And so, so if you have a little bit of banana around and there's Africanized bees around, they're going to think that there's another bee around that is saying, "Hey, come and attack this thing." And so you brought your banana out and now you get attacked by Africanized bees. So that's an example of, having a long range to this volatile pheromone here. And then, you've got these spreadable contact pheromones that are somewhere in between. They're longer, but so they don't necessarily get up in the air. So they're polar, they're heavy compounds, and then you can spread them on contact. So there's some that you produce on your own body, there's some that you actually can spread on other bodies. So, but just in general, the weight of the chemical tells you its range, and the range tells you its function. All right, questions about that? Does that make sense? So, I mean, for me, this is really exciting because you can take all that stuff. I mean, you might find this boring, but for me, it's not boring. And I think, like, I find molecular biology extremely boring, but I find organic chemistry extremely boring. When I was at your stage and I was taking chemistry classes or whatever, I just did not, it did not click. But when I saw this, it all started to click because now I could see that all of that stuff that was just memorizing an O-chem, now it had functional value. It's like, oh, I can see now that really long, like certain organic properties lead to certain potential functions in biology and others lead to other functions. And suddenly it became exciting again. So at least for me, this is really exciting, this kind of category of, mapping molecular properties to function. Okay. Now that brings up, on the subject of memorizing things. We do have some content grammar here. And I, when we talk about communication, I talk about cues, signals, ritualization. Here's two other biggies: primers and releasers. So, and this doesn't just apply to chemicals, although it's very often applied to chemicals. It is also applied in physiology. So you talk about primers and releasers in terms of hormones as well. But a primer is a, these are types of signals. So they're already signals, benefit to both sender and receiver. A primer is a signal that has a slow physiological change. So you don't get an immediate behavior, you get a slow change in, so it makes things kind of, so like a primer, it's like a queen can prime the workers around her to not try to produce their own eggs. So a queen is sort of constantly giving a signal of her reproductive status, and that's creating long-term changes, not immediate behavioral releases in the workers. Then we've got a releaser, like an alarm pheromone, where it's instantaneous. Once you get that, then you immediately release a behavior. So Tinbergen talked about a seagull parent's got that nose, got that big bright spot on the end of their nose, and he figured out that there's aspects of that spot that are a releaser. If you have a hungry chick, then if you bring in a fake beak that has the right color combination at the tip of it, then that chick will open its mouth. If it has different color combination, it won't. So that color combination was a releaser. It released the behavior of opening the mouth in order to receive food. So that's what I mean. A signal that has an immediate response is a releaser. A signal that there can be primers that make things that make behaviors more sensitive to releasers. So some like there are some ants that you lay a trail pheromone and the pheromone by itself doesn't attract any ants. But if you also put a primer by their nest and then and that primer itself doesn't change them at all. But if you couple the primer by the nest and then you also paint the trail pheromone, then you get a robust trail down that trail pheromone. So they needed the primer to tell them to start paying attention to the releaser. And once the primer was there, then they would respond to the releaser with the trail and behavior. So that's what we mean by long-term and short-term. So questions about that, primers and releasers. Long-term is primers. They prime you for something, but you don't actually do it. Releasers, you immediately release the behavior. Behavioral ecologists love to say things like, we've released the behavior, like, oh, that released the behavior. So you hear about fixed action patterns sometimes in psychology, and the thing that triggers that fixed action pattern, that's the releaser. Okay, so those are two big terms too. Remember those, primers and releasers. Signals, cues, ritualization, primers and releasers. Big terms, looking into the midterm. Questions? Yeah, I'm sorry. No, it's not pure. They can be visual, it can be acoustic. Releasers are often, they are in chemical ecology, people love these terms. But in any sensory modality, we can refer to primers and releasers. And they don't have to be innate. You can also have sort of like learned releasers as well. Other questions? All right. Yeah, so like the learn that I mentioned that innate thing because this comes up sometimes. Like sometimes we observe a releaser in nature, like, oh, whenever this frog sees a yellow, they run away or something like that. And we could say that released the behavior. But then that opens new causal questions up. So we notice a mechanism, yellow does that. But then we can ask developmental questions about is that innate or not? So then we can then say, you know, let's show all frogs yellow and do they all respond that way? Let's show juvenile frogs yellow and adult frogs yellow. Do they respond that way? And then we can start interrogating the kind of developmental hypotheses. So, but we would still refer to it as a releaser, even if it's a learned releaser. Okay, great. Other questions? All right, so let's do a clicker. Give you guys some opportunity for credit. Okay, so what is thought to be the original function of cuticular hydrocarbons, CHCs, for insects? Is it A, to prevent drying out, B, communication, C, self-defense, D, subduing prey? Of course, this is hypothetical, but there's been a lot of evidence that has supported this. So these are all hypotheses. So I'm basically saying which hypothesis is best supported by evidence. You know, phylogenetically, which thing came first? So let's see, we've got most of the class. I'll give you maybe 15 more seconds. 10 more seconds, maybe. All right, so I'm going to hit stop in 5, 4, 3. If you don't know, just take a guess. And there we go, a full 1 minute. Okay, so how many people say, well, so most people, I'll just say, and so but good, about 90% said about prevent drying out. And then there was sort of a distribution around these. It is true that they're currently used for communication, but they are also currently used for prevent drying out. And the evidence supports that this drying out came first. So that is what we generally think that their primary function before they got co-opted into communication was to prevent drying out. Okay, great. Questions about that? Right, there we go. All right, so modes of communication. So that was a lot of the, you know, just laying out some of these. So a couple more examples here. So auditory. So, you know, what are the other ways that we can communicate? So through sound, through acoustics. I've shown this one before. These termites do what's known as termite head banging. They bang their head against things. Ants do this as well. Some ants do this as well. And it creates these acoustic signals, these very rapid head banging here. This is the slowed down version where you can see the head go up and come down. It's thought to recruit other termites to the area in case there is an incursion by some big, you know, dangerous mammal. But it also has inter-specific, you know, signaling because, you know, ideally it would be great if the mammal would just run away. And maybe to the mammal, hearing that this is an active termite colony with lots of big angry soldiers, maybe that's something that is useful for the mammal as well. So there could actually be inter-specific signaling where it benefits both the receiver, the mammal, and the termite. But there's definitely intra-specific signaling because we see that once a few of them start doing it, then a bunch more respond. So the non-soldiers go deeper into the colony, and the soldiers come up to that area and they start headbanging as well. So it's an acoustic alarm signal. Okay. Other ways that this happens to be, insects do this. So the crickets, they make noises, as you'll read about. And so we use this term stridulation for a particular way of producing sound with this thing called a file and teeth. And so you can imagine your knuckles against your knuckles. If you kind of drag them against each other, you can kind of feel like a thump, 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 thump. Well, imagine if they're really close together and you take that comb and you run it against another it. Well, that's they there's an they have these anatomical structures on their cuticle that scrapers and files, what they're called here. So you can see this stridulatory file with its teeth, and it goes up against a scraper, and that is what creates that. And they're so tightly spaced together that it creates a high-pitched sound, and that's what you hear when you hear a cricket. So that's referred to as stridulation. So it's this specific way of making sound by running teeth against a scraper, stridulation. All right. The other way that some insects, here's an example of stridulation. So these are different species. And so they have a different signals that are emitted. So you could imagine kind of like the barcode is really actually a good analogy here. So those teeth, you could imagine putting different patterns there, like a player piano. It's got, the ones that you put a piece of paper in, it's got holes, and those holes cause different keys to be played. And so then you can have it, automatically play a piece of music. Well, you could do the same thing with these anatomical structures. You can make the structures pattern in different ways so that as you run a scraper across them, then they make different noises. And then you can also, of course, change the speed of how you're running the scraper across them and so on. And so across different species, you can get different types of signals that sound differently. And so different shapes and patterns give us different volume and different pitch. So the loudness is what we refer to as the amplitude, and the pitch is the frequency. And so, as we can see here, when we talk about frequency, we have to think of it also as a spectrum. So, just like the chemical signals have different spots where they've got double bonds and methyl branch groups and so on, then acoustic signals mix different frequencies. So, it's not just that, like, oh, this one sounds like 20 hertz and this one sounds like 30 hertz. This one is a certain mixture of 20 and 30 hertz. This one is another mixture of 20 and 30 hertz and 5 hertz as well. And so we can actually use tools to take these patterns and break them into their frequency components and characterize animals by which frequencies they use in their signals. Just like the sound of my voice, there's a primary frequency, but I don't sound like a pure tone, unless I ran it through like an auto tuner. Then I've got a complex combination. The same thing with the crickets. All right. Any questions about stridulation? The idea there of you just running this comb against a scraper? Okay. So so we're just talking about the same low frequency and high frequency there. Now, what's kind of interesting about this frequency thing is that's the generated frequency. That's what a machine hears. But your ear doesn't hear every frequency the same, and neither do the sense organs on a cricket. And so we have to also worry about the perception. So just, this goes back to the umwelt of the animal. It's not just what's happening in physical space, but what actually makes it to their central nervous system? What makes it through the filter of their peripheral nervous system to get into their central nervous system? And humans, this is for the human auditory system. So there are certain sounds that certain frequencies that we are very sensitive to, other frequencies, you have to play them very, very loud in order for us to notice them. And so just because you see certain frequency components, that doesn't mean they're perceived in the same way. So that's one of the cautions when you're studying acoustic communication, really any communication. You not only have to study what's going on at the sender, but what is the perceptual system of the receiver? And so, that's just sort of a caution there. So questions about what I mean by that. Does that seem clear? Again, this goes back to the idea of the umwelt, that even if there's certain colors in nature, if you can't see those colors, it might be you generate those colors just by accident. Like there's no cost to generating those colors, so it's never selected out, but your receiver may not actually be receiving them. For all I know, this shirt, like there are, for reasons that we won't discuss here, there are women that can see, they have four types of cones in their eyes, only women, not men. And so those, that gives them the ability to see colors that other women and other men can't see. And to them, I might have a very different colored shirt on than I can see right now. They just perceive things that I just can't even perceive. I won't even realize are there. So, that goes around, you have to understand the umwelt of your animal. It's very, very complex. Okay. The other big organ that we talk about in insects for creating sound is the timbal, spelled both of these different ways. This is the organ that you have in the group of cicadas. So it is, the cicadas have got this big resonant body like a guitar, and this timbal is this kind of this membrane that vibrates, again, kind of like a guitar. And so, the interesting noises you hear out of a cicada are not from stridulation. They're from this organ, which is a very different type of organ. So it's, rapid muscles vibrate. So again, it's like the strings of a guitar. The muscles vibrate, and the body acts as a resonant chamber for amplifying its sound. So with a cricket, it's like running a comb against the side edge of a table. With a cicada, it's a little bit more like a guitar, where the muscles are generating vibrations that then resonate inside the body to produce this sound through the kind of, again, it's a little bit like the soundboard or whatever in a guitar. That's the timbal. All right, so those are the two big sense organs that, or sorry, not sense organs, the two big sound-producing organs or sound-producing methods that I want you to know that come out of the large group of animals from the insects. Stridulation and the timbal. Okay. Now, questions about those two organs. Now, it's not all about insects. And so here's an example that comes out of monkeys. So when we talk about any type of communication, but this is a specific example for acoustic, then we do get the emergence of meaning in different signals. And so I've already sort of given some examples of that, like blue eggs and red eggs, they mean different things. But in these transient acoustic signals, you also get the emergence of something that is almost language-like. So they did playback experiments. So again, you do playback experiments in Bio-435, where they basically played back recorded calls of different monkeys to see what behaviors are released by those calls. And what they found is that calls, they went out into the forest and they waited, they got these calls by waiting for certain threats to go by. So when there was an eagle going by, they then said, okay, turn on the recorder. Let's record monkey calls when the eagle is coming by. When there's a snake nearby, let's also do that. When there is a leopard nearby, let's record those calls. And then they went into an area that did not have eagles, snakes, or leopards, and they played the calls back. And what they found is that the calls, and these all sounded different. The eagle-triggered calls, monkeys that heard it would run to take cover and look up. So they would get under something. The snake-triggered calls, the monkeys wouldn't move, but they'd look down. And then the leopard-triggered calls, then they would run to the nearest tree and go straight up. So this seems to suggest that the alarm call for these monkeys is pretty complex, that there's at least three different alarm calls that have meaning, specific meaning. They release different behaviors. So you get semantics that involve or emerge from these different alarm calls, which I think is pretty cool. So interesting, I think, example of acoustics being used in different ways. Okay, so there's a lot of other examples I could go into with acoustics. A lot of animals hear, a lot of animals perceive. Even if they can't hear the way you and I do, they might feel vibrations in a way that also is, so there's lots of different things that we could talk about here, which we won't get into. We've talked a little bit about auto communication with bats. They end up, emitting signals that come back to them. So yeah, rich area. By no means have we covered it exhaustively, but just wanted to give you a couple of things to think about with acoustics. All right, I'm going to skip this one just for time purposes. And then visual communication. So another very big one. So at least for humans, it feels very big because we are very visual. Other animals maybe aren't very visual, but at least it feels like there's really interesting visual patterns out there. And so I just want to highlight, again, I can't go through an exhaustive list, but when we talk about visual signaling, we're often talking about when you're in the light, color. So, colors communicate lots of interesting things. But when you're in the dark, the presence of light. So we also have bioluminescence is a way to communicate, in interesting ways. And so down deep in the dark, whether you can turn on or off a light may be a useful communication modality. So, those are things when we look at animals, if we notice variations in color, if we notice the ability to generate light, it starts making us ask causal questions. Why does it do that? How is that color generated? Mechanistic, functional questions. Do they always have that color? Developmental questions, and so on. Evolutionary questions about, at what point did this color come up? So we start looking for color and asking these questions about color or light. But it's not all about intra-specific communication. There's also concealment. And so one of the interesting things about these different environments, like if you're especially in three-dimensional environments. So again, think about this kind of goes back to the umwelt of the animal. You and I live on a plane. And so we often I had a behavioral ecologist used to work with once watched his bike get stolen from his like 10th floor office. And he looked down, it wasn't here, it was on a different campus. And he looked down at it and he like took a video of it and he got the bike back and whatever. And he noticed that the human stealing his bike would look left and right, didn't think to look up, because humans don't look up. The risks don't come from above. But, in that weird artificial case where he's on the 10th floor, he could watch his bike getting stolen and the guy had no idea that he was being observed. So likewise, though, some animals have evolved for three dimensions, and those are the ones that live in the sea. And so sharks, for example, sharks have countershading. So the bottom of a shark looks different than the top of a shark. And that allows them to be difficult to see as a predator, whether you're looking down or looking up. So they want to match the view when you're looking up, and they want to match the view when you're looking down. And so they express different colors, not for communication with other sharks, but apparently for concealment to prevent eavesdropping by other animals. Likewise, there's counterillumination. There are organisms like squid that collect bioluminescent bacteria in an organ that they can express on the bottom of their body. And at night, they create a high concentration of those bacteria, and the bacteria use this thing called quorum sensing. And then they really detect that there are bacteria around them, they start producing light. So the squid cause the bacteria to turn on like a big flashlight. And when there's a bright moon behind them, then they're lost in the moon. They don't become a shadow anymore. But from the top, they don't have that. So looking down, you don't see the bright signal. Now, during the daytime, they actually get rid of some of these bacteria so that they get under that density and it turns off the light. So they don't shine the light at daytime. And then the bacteria grow. And then so that by night, it's at density levels so that they can turn on the light again. So not only can you have counter shading where that's sort of fixed, it's just your color, but you also have counter illumination where you can create bioluminescent underside that allow you to turn on and off color to hide yourself in three-dimensional spaces. So I think these are pretty cool phenomenon that you see, but you really only see in things that live in 3D, not like us. Umwelt. Okay, and then I mentioned it before, so I just want to mention it briefly here, the electric modality. We don't often think about the electric modality, but a lot of other animals, cartilaginous fish, in particular, there's a lot of actually fish that have the ability to perceive electricity and use electricity in different ways. And so when we see an animal behaving in a particular way, we sometimes need to ask, have we considered every modality that that animal can sense? And even though we can't sense it, the animal might be able to. And electricity is one of those. So there are strongly electric fish that use their electric signals for predation. So they can kill or shock other fish, and then that gives them an advantage to attack their prey. Now, what's interesting is there's also weakly electric fish that use these signals for communication and electrolocation, similar to echolocation. So they can send off weak signals, and then they can detect there's an obstacle there, there's a prey item there. And it's not actually stunning the prey, but it's giving them information similar to bats' echolocation, but it's electric echolocation, so electrolocation. So that's what we talk about electrolocation here, or communication. They can sense the presence of other weakly electric fish. So I want to draw the analogy back here to remember the poison gland in tandem running. So this was originally for something that was more for predation and, these offensive and defensive behaviors, these aggressive behaviors. And over time, it got then used intraspecifically for communication. And I don't actually know if that is the right phylogenetic story for strongly to weakly electric fish. I'm not a fish guy, but I have a feeling somebody knows or somebody's investigating that. And it would not surprise me if a similar story was going on here. So, co-option for communication. Any questions about the fish or electric signaling? Okay. So, and then finally, mix and match. So, we talked about a lot of modalities today, multimodal communication. Let's mix those modalities to create different aspects of the same signal, like video and audio tracks. And a great example of this is these frogs, which not only have very loud croaking, which they use during mating, but they also have very conspicuous visual signaling, this sac that they inflate. And you say, how is that useful? Well, if you think about it, a female looking at all these males, they hear the croaking. Now, we don't know exactly what it is about the croak that attracts the female to that. There are people that study that. But whatever it is, the female hears that croak, and now she needs to locate the male. But if these males are all around here, how do you tell which male emitted that croak? The croaks are synchronized with the visual channel. So if the female hears a croak she likes, now she needs to look for the visual channel to say, oh, that, it's an honest combination that croak is made when that inflates. And so they know that, oh, that croak is the one I like, because now I've used my visual. So it's a different modality that helps them home in on the exact sender of the croak that they like. So they might evaluate the acoustic, but then they use the visual, which is synchronized with the acoustic, to actually locate the individual. That's what we mean by a multimodal signal, where two modes are communicating different aspects of the same signal. It's not redundancy in this case. You really need both modes in order to achieve the function. Questions about that example? How that's different than just redundancy? All right, I think that's the last example I've got for you. So, big things today, primer and releaser. And actually, I would know stridulation and timbal, like these sound-producing organs, pheromones, the pheromones and semiochemicals. Those are the things that I really highlight about stuff today. There's your reminders and our last clicker here. If I can find it, there we go. So we'll do a short answer. And in your short answer, I want you to answer the question, have you attempted the lockdown browser compliance test? Yes or no? So just respond either a yes or a no in your short answer, or a Y or an N, that's fine. So have you completed your lockdown browser compliance tests. That's all I've got. We'll wrap up communication on Tuesday. Have a nice weekend. Yep.
I don't know. These guys are running the review sessions, so you can ask them or request that from them. Yep.
Like a little bit.
No, so we need to.
More interested in it. Is it like what's the structure of the class? I know.
I've not taught it. Leaders usually teach on it, so I would ask him if we run into it. But from what I understand, I think he's over a couple of fundamentals, like we learned Timbergen's four. But then I think throughout the rest of the course, you're going to learn some standards, like you're going to call back these sorts of things. Okay. Everybody, you're going to go outside.
Yeah.
And you're going to do it like in nature or in the lab. There's going to be tours of labs, so you can visit people's labs, and maybe for that day, you get to do an experiment in there.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the class, you'll set up your own experiment. So maybe you'll go and collect scorpions. And then do a scorpion experiment.
Yeah.
And you could, and what you write up there could go into a portfolio or whatever that you could use, like in a job application. I think actually, Anushka, taken the grad version of 435, right? So she was wondering how it's structured. So the grad students are in there too. They have a slightly different assessment structure, but you're doing the same.
But
she just wanted an overall structure over here.
Yeah, I'm really interested in it. I mean, I really like to
see stories.
So basically, like,